David, thank you very much, first of all, for your book and for joining us here at Trades Hall. Are you a moral crusader? Is that what this is about?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of an immoral crusader, I guess. And in the sense that it's... you can see from the book. There are some things I take very seriously, some things I don't take very seriously. In fact, I think I was the opposite to the people that ran the Defence Force, who were... abstemious, you know, politely mannered and always dressed well, but I think when push came to shove, they didn't do the right thing. And I often thought that was right. I was the opposite to them. I don't know which one's right and which one's wrong, but I was kind of that old school, the sort of people I idolised from the Second World War, maybe the, you know, hard drinkers. Not particularly well behaved, perhaps in their personal life, but did the right thing when it really mattered. I guess they were the sort of people I've always idolised. So I don't go around telling people that they should drive to the speed limit and such things. But I do think that when you swear an oath to a country, it's very important and it really matters. And that when you join the Defence Force. You are meant to do everything you can to defend the country, and that means doing everything right. In fact, as you as a lawyer, you're one of the few people that know that also, that really understand that when you're a lawyer, it's serious about, you know, you can be as disreputable as you like in your personal life, but the duties to the court and things like that, they take that very seriously.
You also learn as a lawyer that you shouldn't get too close to your clients and you shouldn't become emotionally involved in their causes. So is that where, in a way, you became emotionally involved in your military service? Is that, in a way, what led you to do what you have now pleaded guilty to in the courts of releasing official secrets?
Yeah, and if you want to treat the nation of Australia as your client, I guess I was too close to that client. But I don't... I mean, you swear to go and, if necessary, die for your country. I mean, that's a pretty big deal. So I don't see... people have probably said to me, I think I mentioned in the book, I'm a bit wound up, a bit too tight, took my duty a bit too seriously, but I don't agree with that. I think you have a duty. You either do it or you don't. If that means going to jail, I mean, but people that we grew up with as role models with, people we got burnt at the stake for, you know, translating the Bible into English or saying that the Pope wasn't God or whatever, these are the sort of people that I grew up thinking were role models. So I don't know that standing up for the rule of law is taking things too seriously. I mean, that's what we're meant to do, I thought.
Ego is not a dirty word, as Skyhooks reminded us. So was it in part ego? Is it ego to think I know better than the system, I know better than the generals, I know better than the military commanders? My version of what's right and wrong overwhelms theirs.
Oh, I think they say that about every whistleblower, you know, that is, they've got big ego. I don't think that's the case for me. It wasn't a matter of having a different interpretation of the law. I believe that we habitually misinterpreted ignored the law. It would be a bit like saying someone who complained about robo-debt was just an egomaniac, you know. I mean, would you agree with that? No, fuck no. You know, it was wrong. It was clearly wrong. And what I saw in the Defence Force was about three different robo-debts. Now, I don't think that makes me an egomaniac. I think it makes me someone that did my job.
Sure. I guess I'm driving at a slightly different point. One of the disclosures that quite surprised me as I went through the book was when there was a notorious incident in Afghanistan where you were on an overseas mission as a military lawyer, and some soldiers severed the hand of a suspected Taliban terrorist and took it back, I think you say for the purpose of identification. What did you make of that incident?
Well, soldiers, it was handled badly in all ways, excuse the pun, but it was, there was no evidence to suggest he was doing anything but what he said. He wanted to get the fingerprints. It was in a very dangerous place. They had to get out of there fast. And it wasn't actually illegal. It became a firestorm and because it sounded bad. It sounded bad to the ABC reporters who heard about it. It sounded bad to and everybody dumped. I guess it was the underdog spirit in me that wanted to defend that soldier, in the sense that everybody dumped him, even his own commanders, who obviously knew about it, pretended they didn't know about it. And that was what drew me to him, to say, hang on, it's not clear. And the guy was never charged, even though everybody made a big fuss. It wasn't clear that he'd actually broken any laws. It was pretty clear that he thought he was doing the right thing. The police, for example, cut hands off people if they can't retrieve the body in the bottom of a lake or something. And so what I was standing up for to say, he hasn't clearly broken any laws, and just because the media have got a hold of it, and it's shocking, obviously it's shocking to everyday people, we need to sometimes front the cameras and say, this is what we do in war. You might not like it, but he didn't actually breach any military procedures. But of course, nobody had the backbone to have that press conference. And if anyone was going to take the blame, it should have been the general to say, well, we'll have to change our procedures or whatever. But of course, the generals wouldn't do that. They just
never do they?
No, they didn't do. They didn't want to have no one. There's an aversion these days of having that hard press conference, except for Dan Andrews. he does it, but generally, people don't want to front. If it's bad news, they don't want to front the cameras, which I think is wrong. You've got to you get paid the big bucks by sometimes giving unpleasant news. But I guess that's why it's called the nature of honour. I understand that for a lot of people, they think that that's strange. Sometimes people deserve to go to jail, and sometimes if they haven't clearly breached any orders. And one of the things that they said about that guy, the General Morrison, he wrote a letter about it, and he said, soldiers need to think about what the media is going to think. And it was just the media, like what, you know, John Fain or Alan Jones or who exactly. And soldiers need to follow orders, and the orders need to be set out in clear format. And you can't be saying to soldiers in the SAS, you should have thought of what, you know, the Guardian were going to think of this before you did your action. We can't always put the... This is one of the problems with the military at that time. They put all the risk on the person at the bottom rather than having someone at the top saying, I will front the cameras. I will, you know, you're my responsibility, like you're my child or whatever. And if someone has to take a fall on this, it will be me, not you.
And is that absence of accountability at the highest level at the very core of your disillusionment with your time in the army?
Yeah, it would be. That's a beautiful way of putting it. And when I went to Sandhurst in the late 80s, that was definitely what we were taught. And it was a kind of... I noticed this, and I say in the book, there was an inverse ratio with in Australia, where the Australian soldiers were fitter, they were better educated, you know, much more Adonis-looking like than the British soldiers, and the British officers, you know, were chinless wonders, as we called them, but they understood that if the shit hit the fan, it was the officer who was going to take the rap for it, because he could do that, rather than the soldier who came from a poor background, couldn't afford to lose his job, and that kind of accountability, we'd lost that in Australia, where people were prepared to say, I'm at the top, I get paid the big bucks, and rather than the people underneath me taking the blame, if they weren't trained properly, it's my fault. If they didn't do the right things, unless they directly breached orders, it's my fault. Yeah, that kind of old school accountability has gone as we've become more and more of a political force.
The book recounts your various encounters with the military when you're in the UK, you're serving in Ireland, you're backwards and forwards then as a reservist, but when you're back in Australia and so on. There's a sort of on-off love affair with the military through however many years. What is it now? Nearly 40 years?
Mm. Yep, and, that's right.
And yet you seem, at various times you describe how you're pretty pissed off with how things are and then you go back to it. And as a, you know, as a newcomer to your story, as a reader of the book starting from zero, I didn't quite understand why you kept going back when it was so obviously causing you some distress.
Well, I like the public service. I miss that. As a commercial lawyer and someone probably something you can relate to as a lawyer who became a broadcaster, I missed really feeling like I was doing something worthwhile as a commercial lawyer. And I noticed, for all its flaws, it was there was something worthwhile about putting on a uniform for your country and getting out, if it was done well. I still have that love affair that, in the sense that the perfect scenario for me would be to go back to the Defence Force as some sort of consultant, because I can see there are problems being a political force and having a minister to answer for and help them better deal with the problem. It's easy to criticise without having a solution, but to say, how do we deal with the fact that a minister's telling you to do something you know it's wrong? How do we better, maybe might need to change the laws or change our procedures, because if the minister can sack the CDF and the Chief of the Defence Force, and how do we better manage that civilian-military relationship so everybody's a bit happier? At the moment, it's too one-sided, it's too political, and I would love to go back. I mean, I do still miss it, you're right. I'd probably go back, then I'd leave again, a bit like one of those old-school punch and duty relationships. I did actually, they didn't know I was a whistleblower, but after I was already been speaking to journalists secretly, and I was off with PTSD, and I did come back for a managed return to work, and I couldn't do it because you could see all these major things wrong with the Defence Force and millions missing and things like that, and they were still chasing you for, you know, a $50 cab charge receipt or something like that, and that it's hard to weigh those two things up when you can see that there are big things wrong with an organisation, and yet all they care about is the small things.
Talk us through the culture of the leadership of the Army as you experienced it, because you had a fantastic opportunity. You had an education that was the envy of most of your peers. You've been through Sandhurst and Cambridge and the British military, service in Ireland, blah, blah, and, you know, playing polo, skiing at St. Moritz, all this sort of stuff. And then you go working in the Army. Talk us through the culture clash, in a way, that you tell us about in the book.
Yeah, I always wanted to be a soldier, and I thought that it wasn't mutually exclusive to having an interesting life at the same time. I was quite surprised how political the Australian military was. The British Army from my memory, which may be rose-coloured, it wasn't so political, I guess, because it hadn't been that long since the Second World War, and they'd had a real war. And I think Vietnam was the beginnings of things being different in Australia to the UK, and the Americanisation of the Australian military seems to have been the beginning of the end. I noticed I said to my friends who were more old school, how did the Australian military become so political? And they seemed to say it was after the Vietnam War, and there was an inquiry to say, I think that there were occasions when the ministers would say, such and such is happening, we're winning or something, and they'd get counter, there'd be opposite statements coming from Vietnam. And after the war, from the commanders, and after the war, the commanders, there was some sort of inquiry to say, that's not going to happen anymore. If a politician says something, you know, you don't contradict them. And it seems to have gone from there. So it's a different animal, the Australian military to the British military. It is far more like the minister's office and the CDF's office are sort of next to each other. I think it's become a little bit unhealthy, and I think a lot of it is to do with the American influence.
We've seen various politicians, prime ministers and defence ministers and home affairs ministers conduct joint press conferences with senior leadership in uniform, which has been regarded at various times as blurring the distinction. So do you see that as a problem? Is that something that shouldn't be allowed?
Yeah, that's a big problem. And I saw that he's still the Chief of the Defence Force now, Campbell did actually stop Christopher Pyne trying that once. Because they definitely do that, and that is a problem. And I believe, actually, it probably goes back to Howard. And probably, if you dug deep enough, Crosby Textor polling, where I think that they seem to have worked out that whatever, and this would probably go back to Vietnam as well, whatever the public think about the Defence Force, or if they like the Defence Force at the time, they're more likely to vote for the incumbent government, and if they don't like the Defence Force, they're more likely to get a revolution and vote for the opposition. And so they seem to see the popularity of the Defence Force as the same as the popularity of the government, and so there is so much spin and there is so much photo opportunities of minister general, you know, minister standing on top of submarine, etc. It seems to be increasingly a prop for any kind of election to make them look good. You can't get a minister out of a tank, you know, they're always there. We had Gillard come to see us in Afghanistan, and Tony Abbott came twice, and Stephen Smith was there with his makeup artist. So he looks just a little bit weary, but not too weary. It's considered, you know, the most fantastic sort of by-election to be somehow there with the troops. And unfortunately, one of the things that used to really rile me was them going to military funerals as well, and having lots of funerals. Like someone would die in Afghanistan, and they seemed to have about four or five funerals for the same person. And always with press, or even if it was just the military press, lots of photographers there, lots of shows, because they were milking it, because they know that the public is quite sentimental and quite supportive of the forces. And so to get yourself a photo at a wedding or a funeral, looking suitably downcast, even though you might have sent the soldiers there, or it might have been your fault that they died, is it gives you a bump in the polls, and that sort of thing used to really wire me up.
Is that a view widely shared in the top level of the military? Do the top brass sort of feel the same disdain towards their political masters? Or is that just you?
I think that they'd be too afraid to say it. You know, there's a lot of people that agree with me, but they too...
They won't say it publicly, but privately, when you're all, you know, sitting down together away from anybody else hearing.
Yeah, of course. I mean, they join the Defence Force to defend Australia, not to defend the minister. But they do seem to weed them out. I don't know how. This is a magic trick. I've never worked out how they do it, but they seem to be able to select people like David Hurley, your friend and mine, who are yes men. And they seem to...
you mean his what is he? His
Excellency.
Not his Highness, no, His Excellency, thank you, the Governor General.
His Excellency.
The worst Governor General we've ever had, I reckon, don't you think?
His Excellency, isn't that funny?
I once read all his speeches. Do you want to fall asleep reading something? Unbelievable. Sorry, David, he's just a dud.
Yeah, and let alone the dodgy charity. But he seemed to... they seemed to be able to pick yes men quite early. In fact, there was a famous... There's an apocryphal story, which is good to tell, because I don't think I've ever said this before, about Angus Campbell's... brother. He's got two brothers. One's a complete idiot. But apparently one is... was a really good officer, a guy called Jock Campbell. And as a major, Jock Campbell stood up against a bullying commander and apparently was absolutely in the right. And yet they got rid of Jock Campbell because he was a problematic sort of guy, or considered problematic after that. And now now it's the tragic end. He teaches English as a foreign language in Canberra or something. Someone who could have really been a great leader. But they don't really want anybody who is prepared to say no, Minister. And they seem to be able to work out who those people are relatively early on.
Do you think the military would protect Australia in the event of a war? Or are they, in your view, so degraded by all the things you've been discussing today and that you describe in the book, that we're actually at risk?
I think we are at risk, and that's always been my... That's why I think what I say is not egomania or anything to do with me second-guessing other people's legal opinion. I don't think we're defended. I don't think we're defended because we spend the last 40 years defending the minister and putting out brochures, and it's like the Hollow Men. Everything is about the brochure, everything is about all the utopia. Everything is about the public affairs story. I mean, I believe Ben Robert Smith was talked up because he was so handsome and because he was great press, and he popularised the war. I believe certain other people were demonised because that putting them in jail satisfied the sort of media imperative of the day. Now, that is a really bad way to run a defence force. If nothing else, I think the way they justify it is to say we simply don't have enough people to defend Australia, which is probably true. We don't really have enough. Our defence force is quite tiny. We've probably only got enough to defend Darwin. I wouldn't even know if we could do that. But we... So they say, therefore, we have to get into bed with the Americans. That is the only way we can defend Australia. So we defend Australia by sucking up to the Americans. Now, that doesn't sit right with me because Australia is more than a landmass. Australia is a set of values. Australia is abiding by the law. Australia is standing for something. It's everything from Mabo to whatever it is that means something to you. And the problem with we're getting into bed with the Americans is we lose all of that, and they don't abide by the law, and we necessarily we become debased, and we have already lost Australia without a shot being fired, and that is a problem for me. I think we could defend it. I think it'd be a bit like the Second and First World Wars, when all the regular generals would last a few months. The people that lost Singapore and things like that, and then we'd get rid of them and we'd bring in reservists, people who were like Monash, who wasn't a full-time officer, and they would come to the fore, and we would end up defending Australia quite well. But the permanent people, the full-time politicians, would be hopeless.
Can we talk about you personally in some of the time we've got left? And there is an opportunity for questions shortly, in about another 15 minutes. There's a couple of things that jumped off the page at me. You came back from overseas and joined the Labor Party and then went to work for a Liberal politician, Peter King, the member for Wentworth, who was before Malcolm Turnbull was the member for Wentworth. How does that work?
I needed a job. And I told Kingy that. Kingy was my rugby coach. And I'd always been interested in politics.
You mean back at school?
At Sydney University, yeah.
At uni, right, OK.
And I knew him and I said I was in the Labor Party, and he said, I was already a branch member. I hadn't done much, but he said, that's no problem. He said, don't renew your membership. But yeah, I didn't. I was a big believer. Funnily enough, I was a big believer in Tony Blair because he bought, he helped bring about the Good Friday Agreement, where there was peace brought to Northern Ireland after, who knows, 30 depending
generations.
On you, depending on how you calculate it, a long time of troubles. And and I thought that was pretty impressive. And I thought maybe that, you know, that when I came back to Australia, I wanted to get involved. I'm a joiner. You know, I don't like the idea of sitting on the sidelines and talking out the side of your mouth in the pub about how bad politics is. You've got to get involved if you want to change things. And yeah, so I joined and I went to a few party meetings and I had some friends there, but then it had only been a couple of years. I was making documentaries, and then I got the job with Weta King, and I think.
And you then went and stood for, you got pre-selection and stood for Parliament for the Liberal Party in Coogee in New South Wales state election. So I'm just wondering about the values equation. If you believe your values are in alignment with the Labor Party, but then you leave it and enrol and then run for the Liberal Party, it's unusual.
It's not really. I mean, the Liberal Party supposedly is meant to be the party of self-reliance and small business. Now, do you think that's actually true? And the Labor Party, the party of the unions and, you know, the worker. I mean, do you think that's true anymore? They're really uniparties. You know, the idea that you couldn't go from one to the other is, you know, it just doesn't stand up.
Well, they're very tribal.
Oh, they're tribal. You might find it hard in the sense that you get stabbed in the back a lot, but or people bring it up. But the idea that that they're really that different, you know, it's not. I don't look at Churchill. He changed parties a couple of times.
Warren Mundine.
Has he changed? I'm in celebrated company. I don't know that values. I would like to think that people you couldn't. I'm pretty sure that most someone like Richard Miles could easily be the Liberal Party. I don't know that there's really. You would really notice the difference between. In fact, if they all swapped seats in Parliament tomorrow, I don't think anyone would really notice. They're just like actors playing a role.
Malcolm Turnbull famously was very Labor aligned until he joined the Liberal Party, which shocked a lot of people.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, I'd be happy to be likened to him. I mean, that's right. He's a pragmatist, and I think people join. They don't really join for workers' rights. Well, they join to try to do something good for the country, and they think, like myself, you think you personally might be able to do that by being an honest person and being help a bit, like being a lawyer. You know, when you've got these hard cases, that you might be able to use your nous to help. To help the downtrodden and make the country better. I guess that's why you join at the beginning, and then you may or may not see that's never going to happen. But like the army, the people that really get ahead, the people that win pre-selections, and the people that become ministers are often people who are just that bent on getting ahead. They don't really believe in anything except their own personal advancement.
Is that what you found in both parties?
Yeah, I think so. I think we've got to this situation now where, and it's not their own fault. It's not because they're bad people, but it's so sort of cutthroat. I think it's like a uniparty now. It's just, I think that like the Minister of Defence and Miles would be the same, and Smith and all the Liberals as well. They don't care about the defence of the country. Miles wants to become the Prime Minister. It's a stepping stone. Stephen Smith desperately wanted to become Treasurer, and I think he probably had ASIO spying on Wayne Swan. I think that's the reality about politics. They don't really care. There's a friend of mine who was in the Labor Party told me that. He said, David, You know, you don't worry about the other party. They're just your political opponents.
For the purpose of the ASIO delegate who is undoubtedly here with us, there's no evidence to substantiate David's claim. It's conjecture on his part, isn't it?
But he said, you know, then you've got the people in the other faction and they annoy you, but they're not the enemy. Well, and he said your real enemies are the people in your own faction.
Totally.
Because they're the ones who are competing for your job. And I think, and there's an element of that. Obviously, there are probably good people and bad people, but it's a professional job just keeping the other people from taking your job each day. And increasingly, like Utopia or something, where it's all about the next press conference. And I met a young PR person who actually worked for Dan Anderson. She's the daughter of a friend of mine. And she was talking about the job, and I was a bit depressed because it becomes as if you're selling washing powder. And she saw the job as, oh, wasn't it great? Well, you know, the minister forgot his lines and we had to do this or whatever. But it's a bit like just being in showbiz, making sure everybody remembers their lines, making sure the brochure goes out on time. And I'm pretty sure, I didn't want to call her on it and be that, you know, annoying friend of your father's kind of thing, but to say it, you understand you're meant to be doing more than just putting on a good show every day, but I don't know that they do think that, you know.
No, politics is showbiz for ugly people, is how it's often been described.
That's right.
Are you still in AA?
I'm still in AA. I've been in and out. I've 4 years.
You're very forthcoming, very frank about that aspect of your life.
Yeah, I think...
This might come as a shock to people in the room who haven't read the book.
I think I learned it from my father's case and also from AA in itself. There is something very attractive about authenticity and honesty, and also probably a bit to do with my own case, where you know you're going to be cross-examined about things. Although saying that, even when I first joined the Liberal Party, I was at pre-selections, which if anyone's ever been to one, they're absolute bloodbaths. And I was honest about it then, because you kind of want to preempt whatever people are going to try to use against you. You want to get out there. I like to be honest about that as a sort of a preemptive thing to say, yeah, I have had a problem with drink. And because a lot of people have, a lot of people warm to it, even if they haven't, you know, that people like honesty. And so I always try to be on the front foot about it.
But you cheated on your colourblindness test when you were trying to get into the SAS, so you don't mind...
No, I don't mind.
Bending the rules a little bit.
No, I don't mind bending the rules if I have to. I did have it with my own. I thought that that was was acceptable. I drove a motorbike without a license too. Some rules are important. Some rules are not that important. But that's right.
Who amongst us has not at some stage done something naughty? Yeah.
I'd like to put that out there. I mean, that's why I put things like that in the book. And I've always... I was happy for people to make up their own mind if they really want to... If they're really unhappy about me cheating on the colourblind test, that's okay. I wear it. And...
I'm sure the prosecution will be relying on it in court at sentencing. <yeah. laughs>
I like to think, yeah, I don't know. Well, I know it's true. You do wonder about it, but maybe you kind of go mad for your own value system. But that seems to, you know, try to work out where you draw the line and where you don't. But one of those funny things, I guess.
And you mentioned your father a moment ago in answer to my previous question, and he comes up in the book all the time, over and over again. First of all, let's not assume everyone in the room knows about your father's brush with authority. So fill us in on that, and then take us through the influence that that experience had on your development.
Yeah, there's some younger people here. They might not know about my father, who was a doctor, and he was credited with discovering a link, or at least observing that there was... A particular drug, which was an aspirin, a paracetamol type, not over the counter, but it was not meant to be particularly dangerous, a morning sickness drug, was causing terrible deformities with children, and not affecting the mother. It was unusual, but actually causing the babies to be born or to grow without arms and legs sometimes, and sometimes just die. And he got a lot of accolades for that, and that affected our childhood, and then he became successful and famous and a lot of press and that kind of thing.
And that was thalidomide.
The drug thalidomide. Which is still sort of, a household name today. Now, 10 years later, or sometime later, 20 years later, he had a fall from grace where it was proved he falsified on a different drug, another drug he thought was causing similar sort of deformities in the United States. And he did experiments on it and claimed to have done experiments, but he said that there were 8 rabbits and there were only 6 rabbits in his experiment. And he suffered all the sort of things that you would imagine a public figure to have when that kind of dishonesty is uncovered.
He was totally discredited, and that was an investigation led by Norman Swan in his early days as the health report presenter on Radio National.
It was, yeah. Yeah. So that had it didn't have as a big effect on me as it perhaps did the rest of the family. I was living overseas at the time, and my Oxford professor said to me at the time, he said, the best thing you can do to help your father is to be a success in your own life. And that was good advice. Not that I didn't already know that, but I think I was trying to use my father's excuse to the fact I hadn't finished an essay on time or something like that. And he cut me down and said, no, that's not going to fly. Sorry, but honey, you got to do your essays. But it had an effect. And I also, it had an effect on me because I saw he didn't help himself, the best thing for him to have done would have been to say, yes, I lied about the rabbits. There was only 6. I did it because I still believe this drug is dangerous and focused on the drug. And I don't know whether it's obvious or not, but that's what I wanted to do when I very first went to the police after I was arrested, and I said, I want to make a statement and I want to make it clear that I did give the documents to the ABC, and I did, but I did it because I felt I was justified, because I wanted to take that off the table. I didn't want to have a 50-week trial where they bought out all the emails and, phone messages or whatever, and went out of their way to prove that I gave the documents to the ABC, and then have me trying to say after that, oh, I felt I was justified. But rather than just focus on what I thought was the key issue...
Control the narrative,
yeah. Focus on that, the issue about whether or not what I'd seen was bad enough.
So you learned that lesson from what happened to your dad?
I don't know whether... I mean, it's a pretty obvious lesson, isn't it? But I mean...
Well, not a lot of people get it, though.
but I guess if I hadn't already known it, yeah, I did. I did learn it from that experience to say... Because that was one of the funny things. Even though he was disgraced about that, it was never actually proved that the drug wasn't dangerous. And but that got lost in the smokescreen over him being dishonest. And had he said, yeah, I did it, but the drug, let's get back to this drug, he might have had a better chance. And so that would have been a better way to play it, to focus, admit. I mean, it's hard to admit you've lied. It's, it obviously would have stuck in your throat, but he could have got it. Coaching from Hugh Grant's people. Everybody loves a celebrity comeback, to sort of like have a cry on Oprah's sofa or whatever, and then move on to the next issue. Yeah.
And you mentioned your father constantly. He's obviously a very formative figure for you. And I think there's only one mention of your mother very early in the book.
Yeah, a lot of that's the editors. They wanted to just keep it... they thought the relationship between my father and I was very important. I wanted to have a little bit more about my mother later, about her going back to work. It's quite an interesting story where she went... After Dad got struck off, she went back to work age 60, which seemed like a very old age at that stage.
Young.
As young. And she worked in one of those, 24-hour medical centres where all the doctors were my age or their son's age. And but it saved her, getting back and being the breadwinner. And she had all these loyal clients and it gave her a real... It really was the best thing, one of the best things that ever happened to her. It seemed like a bad thing, but it actually made... it really gave her a great purpose, and she was a terrific GP. And even though she was working up in King's Cross with a lot of drug addiction, a lot of mad people, and working long hours and pretty dangerous for her, and people would come in the room, because she worked till she was 80, they'd come in the room and they'd see this old lady there and they'd say, "Where's the doctor?" So she was a good, I would have liked to be able to put all that kind of stuff in, but the editor's like, it's not relevant to the story. Your father's thing is relevant to the story, so it's going to go. My father was kind of a bigger influence on me. We were very, very similar. I guess that's just the way it's turned out. We wanted to make the book as readable as possible, and not a single sentence in there wasn't relevant to where I am now.
And very readable it is too. We're almost ready for questions, but obviously we've got to deal with the elephant in the corner of the room. When are you back in court for sentencing? You've pleaded guilty to the official secrets whistleblowing kind of allegation, and you're back in court for sentencing when?
12th of March, so 2 weeks from today.
We're not going to commit contempt of court by trying to tell the judge what would or wouldn't be appropriate or anything else that may influence the process that's still active and alive before the courts. But what are the indications within those constraints? What are the indications of what's going to happen that you can share with us?
Well, the maximum is unlimited. But the judge did say...
In open court?
In open court, yeah. I want me, assessed for what they call an intensive corrective order, which is...
Community service kind of stuff.
Yeah, sort of living at home, community service, not allowed to leave the state of Canberra.
Removing graffiti.
Removing graffiti. John knows it well. He's obviously had some clients. That's exactly what it is. And I was hoping it might be something a bit more glamorous, but no. Removing graffiti. But apparently it's quite satisfying.
Instant gratification, yeah.
Yeah. The pressure hose.
So have you done that assessment?
I've done the assessment. And again, without wanting to second guess, the judge doesn't have to do it, but they seemed to think that I was suitable. They did, was quite a funny story. There was this awkward pause, and we got on quite well as a young person. The assessor, yeah. And then she said, after we had three long appointments, and she said, no one wanted to have this job, she said, because they don't want to have to ask you this question, and which is necessary, I'm going to have to ask it. She said, would you do it again? And it was funny because and then she laughed and I laughed, and I had this long-winded answer about it, and she said, so I take that that's a yes. And I said, yeah, I guess I have to say it's a yes. And she said, if he said anything else, I would have put down his lie.
It's a bit like those conscientious objection cases in the Vietnam War, yeah. Isn't it, where you still had to be assessed for something instead. So yeah. The judge is going to hear submissions from your counsel and from the prosecution, and then when do you expect to have an actual result? On the day or beyond?
I think on the day. I don't think it's rocket science, but...
Are they telling you to bring a toothbrush just in case?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I think even when I entered the guilty pleas before, I did say my goodbyes, thinking that I might get hauled off then.
Yeah, you could have been refused bail. It's quite common for someone, a prisoner as you're then described, to be detained pending sentencing if you've pleaded guilty.
Yeah, I thought that was going to happen. I thought because the maximums are high and they thought that they would at least have to say, well, we don't know how long you're going to get, but you're going to get a fair bit of time. And so it was an emotional day because not every because we flipped and pleaded quite quickly. A lot of people, friends and family, weren't there at the time. So
were your supporters disappointed that you pleaded guilty?
I do occasionally get people who shout at me, say you shouldn't have pled guilty or whatever. Yeah, so people, it's hard to explain to. Not hard, well, it's not easy to explain to say, look, there wasn't any choice. Once the judge had made a ruling that there is no public interest defence, I didn't have a choice. It was just going to annoy the judge. And in fact, it would give the prosecution a free kick where they could blacken your name. And, you know, we've seen it in the sexual assault trials. And now my heart goes out to anybody who's a victim of sexual assault in the the defence the other way around can say, what underwear you were wearing, get all your phone records, how many boyfriends you've had or not had, and it may all be speculation, but they can really smash you on things which are not relevant, but the media will pick up on, you know, the ooh-ah factor means that whatever the prosecutors say about you will make the papers. And you don't go into that unless you've got a chance of winning. And when the judge said, there's nothing, that you know, you will lose because I'm going to say to the jury, there is no exception. No matter what he saw, it doesn't matter. There was no tactically, the right thing to do then was to plead guilty. But of course, a lot of people still say to me, somehow there's a disconnect because people think that by pleading guilty, some people think, some of the sort of people in the chat rooms, they think that by pleading guilty, I don't know what they think, but they kind of think that it somehow means that, I don't know, I'm a war criminal or something, that there's some sort of connection between pleading guilty and saying, you're absolutely right, I'm a really bad person and I finally got to admit it. But it's one of the things that I guess you learn that you're never going to have everybody on side. There's always going to be a percentage, sometimes for some sort of bias, sometimes justified perhaps, and sometimes they just don't really understand the issues at stake.
So, Bernard, just questions in a moment. Last one from me. Bernard Collaery was also being prosecuted for similar types of offences and was given a waiver by the Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, and you sought and failed to get a similar waiver. And part of the deal that Collaery seems to have struck, I don't know that this has ever been publicly announced, but the charges were dropped and he shut his mouth.
Yeah. I didn't know that, but I mean, no, I'm not surprised. He certainly has shut his mouth.
And you haven't.
He takes it serious. I know. I had a funny moment with my daughters. I've got two teenage daughters. One's 18, one's 16, and the younger one who's found the whole process pretty tough. Said to me a couple of months ago. She said, "Dad, if they say to you, we won't put you in jail as long as you keep your mouth shut." What are you going to say? And we both started laughing and I said, no, I wouldn't do it. And she said, good, I'm glad, Dad. So it was quite nice. Yeah, that I think that would be, I don't think anyone doubts that if I had to have some sort of gag order, I'd have to refuse it because, you have to talk about what you believe is the truth, and if it comes at a cost, you just still have to do it. But that's what I believe anyway. But so it's, I'm glad that no one said that that's going to happen, but I guess it would be one of those hard choices if we get it.
It's been absolutely fascinating to be able to pick your brains. Now it's open to you to ask some questions. If you want to ask a question, give me a wave. I've got one, I've got two. So give me a few questions and we'll get the microphone to you, and we've got about 10 minutes. Go ahead. If you want to introduce yourself, feel free to tell us your name. You don't have to.
Yeah, my name's John. How do we create an environment where whistleblowing can thrive?
Oh, you know, it's a very hard one, isn't it? One of the central problems is that those who make the rules, the politicians, have got the most to lose from whistleblowers. And so even though they all say, oh, yeah, we need to have better whistleblower protections, you kind of think that they're winking at each other, saying better whistleblower protections, like get them in jail and shut them up, because... But I think the one phrase answer to that is whistleblower protection authority, some sort of third party who you can explain your issue to, and they can see whether it's got legs, and then they can take it further. Because the problem at the moment is the politicians don't have any incentive to really, apart from trying to win hearts and minds of the public over, they will put in whistleblower protections which aren't actually whistleblower protections, because they don't want people to necessarily, because it might bring them down. I mean, you can't blame them. It's not because they're, I mean, which of us would enable other people, to take us down and ruin our lives, even if we are criminals? It's a hard thing for politicians to do, but whistleblower protection authority is the best, I think, step in the right direction, but it's always going to be hard.
Well, we've seen with both the Anti-Corruption Commission, a new government would bring it in, but the old government, long in office, wouldn't do it. We saw it with FOI. Established governments wouldn't do it, but promised in opposition once elected in Victoria. John Cain brought it in. So it's the sort of thing, whistleblower protection, it's the sort of thing that if you're in the bureaucracy, you're in the machinery, you resist it. When you're fresh, it's the sort of reform that you've made a commitment to and you therefore introduce. Is it like that?
Yeah, hopefully, exactly. That's good. That's a good point to bring it out. To say, it's something that... Unfortunately, we've got this position now where we know the Liberals are never going to do anything like that. So we can't say to the Labor Party, well, if you don't bloody well give us some better whistleblower protection, we're going to vote for the Liberals. That's not going to go very well, is it? So we don't actually have much bargaining power, but hopefully, yeah. We saw that with the NAC exactly once they got, even when they got in for the national corruption. Now that's these secret hearings is a bit unsatisfactory. We don't really know whether anything's going on at all.
I think we can be confident it is.
Yeah, well,
the people they've recruited are.
Paul Brereton's a very good operator, but still it's...
Beyond blemish.
Yeah, but
They're not sitting there twiddling their thumbs doing crosswords.
Well, let's hope so. But it's without us knowing, I mean, how can we know that? And how can we know the next government's not going to put a stop to it what's going on behind, the curtain? But anyway, it's a step in the right direction. But a whistleblower protection authority... There's a misunderstanding. And again, if I can't go back and consult to the defence force, I wouldn't mind consulting to the whistleblower, the government about, because there's a lot of misconceptions, and not surprisingly, Mark Dreyfus doesn't know what it's like to be a whistleblower, and you have to imagine, some sort of hypothetical case, and the legislation's written around the idea that you find out some terrible secret about the government, you go to the Age or the Sydney Morning Herald and they print the story, or the ABC, you get medals and tea and it's fantastic, but you can't get your job back. Now, that's just not realistic anymore. If you've got... We're about to get nuclear-powered submarines and things like that. If you've got a whistleblowing about dumping nuclear waste or something which is a little bit hard, or maybe financial fraud like the bank guys, that the public won't really understand, that even someone that doesn't work in your industry doesn't fully understand, you will struggle to get any media organisation to take it, because it's not something that can be sold to their audience. And so the idea that whistleblowers will necessarily get media attention if they've got a big scandal is just not true. And the legislation is based on the idea that once it's whatever you do is aired, everything goes well. But of course, that's not the case. And probably plenty of worthy whistleblowers that we have never heard of have probably taken their own lives in frustration, because getting a story up is a whole, is a world of pain in itself. And you have to make certain compromises. And the legislation is really based around a hypothetical example which doesn't necessarily exist.
Up the front here, please.
Hi, Lauren. My name's Lauren. Hi. Okay, if I had a magic wand and gave you the power to be defence minister or have the highest position within the military, what would be the first thing you would change?
Our slavery to the United States. I think so much comes with that. Once we could stand alone, we can actually. And the irony is, we would be everything we want to be as a nation, in that we could be the balance of power in the world between China and the US, like the crossbenchers voting according to whichever side happened to be right on particular issues. But the way we are at the moment. There is no difference between Australian foreign policy and US foreign policy, and that is a problem. That means they don't have to buy our allegiance anymore. They've got it forever and a day. In fact, now that they, this terrible word that Richard Miles loves, interoperability, which means we are them and they are us, means that it's never going to change. They have US bases here and treat the country as if it's their country and without paying rent, and that is a real problem, because it means if you get, I mean, we know, depending on what flavour you are, if you think Donald Trump is crazy or Biden is walking cadaver, whatever, imagine what their presidents are going to be like in 10, 20 years' time. You know, Donald Trump III, or, you know, who knows is going to come after these people. They're going to make these people look like they're really sane people. And they are going to be the ones deciding the future of it, you know, Australian, your children, your grandchildren, your great-grandchildren. I think that's wrong. I think we can good enough to stand on our own. I think a lot of things would change for the better after that.
It's time for us to finish, but we have one more question, and I'll extend the time so we can hear it. Thank you.
Hi, David. This is a little bit of a personal question, but if you ended up spending the rest of your life in prison, would that outcome be worth it if, as a result, Australia cleaned up its act?
Yeah, and I don't think anybody would really doubt that. I would say, yeah, for me, David McBride, I would say that's worthwhile. I'd miss my children. But they would be so proud of me, and I'd be so proud of myself if I could get that change. And I guess that's what goes back into your first, John's first question. I'm probably talking for other people, you know. Is he an egomaniac? Is he, not? Maybe I am, but I would do.
Moral crusader was the word.
Moral crusader, yeah. And a bit of an egomaniac behind that, you know. Yeah, maybe I am a bit nuts, but I do. I don't think anyone, at least even my enemies, would say, "Yeah, I would take that. I would take that, and I'd be happy with that."
What if we flipped the question and you had to spend years in jail and you didn't achieve any change, and there was no ripple effect at all?
Yeah, well, that's the hard one, isn't it? But you still have to do it, don't you? You can't. That's the flip side of when you go off to fight the dragon at St. George, you don't know you're going to win. And people used to say this to me when I was in the Defence Force. They'd say, don't start a fight you can't win. And even though that's a well-known phrase, it was actually, it's the definition of cowardice. You start the fights that need to be fought. You stand up for what needs to be stood up for. There were plenty of people, some of my inspirations, the more I looked into it, some of them were teenage girls during the Second World War who were, you know, executed by the Nazis for helping Allied airmen or, you know, just standing up to Nazi abuse. I mean, they started a fight they didn't win. And yet we look at them and say, you are a hero, you're someone that is just amazing. And sometimes you have to stand up for what is right. I mean, that's not that weird to what I was taught as a kid. It's not many people do it in practice, but that's no excuse not to do it yourself.
Thank you for your question. And I've got a late entry for the last question, the one that comes after the last question. So is it quick? Well, it's up to David whether the answer's quick, if the question is. Thank you.
A quick one, maybe as a list. So what would you like us as regular citizens, your supporters to do to support your cause until 12th March, maybe?
What?
Then read the book, support you on
no,
social media.
Don't take
media
my answer away.
Other than that, you're already doing that. So
well, that's a beautiful
raising
thing.
Awareness.
No, I'm only kidding. It's beautiful. Reading the book is something that I'd be very happy for you to do. You've already got one in your hand, but anyway, that is a beautiful thing. Talking, and that's a lovely queer. I can't thank. And before I forget, I really want to thank everybody that's come here tonight, and particularly John as well. He's obviously got better things to do, and we are very grateful. I'm so grateful. As I said, people that have come, trod this rocky road with me have become part of our family. And I really am in love with you all. So, yeah, if you can read the book and talk about it, you've done enough. I once heard an activist say, you need to do more. And I was like, no, these people have done a lot. You've done a pretty good job. I don't think you need to do any more than what you've already done. And just keep on doing what you're doing, and I want you to know that I am so grateful for your support, and for those of you who have come out here tonight. And again, thanks again, John Fain, Melbourne legend, who's given up his time.
David, congratulations on the book, and David's available to sign copies of the book for every one of you, and in particular, if you buy 10 copies of the book, I understand. No,
get two signatures.
It's one of those cases, and they come along every now and again, where we learn through the course of a case before the courts, we learn a little bit more about ourselves as a country, and this is one of them. Progress is neither linear nor inevitable. It doesn't just go along a nice smooth path. It bumps around, sometimes it goes backwards, and it's not inevitable. It happens because people make it happen. And individual people, every one of you, every one of us, we all have a role in that. And there's nothing worse in a democracy than people who are passive and think, oh, it's all up to somebody else to do things. And that's what this is about. We've come together on a busy weekday evening. And no, I haven't had anything better to do tonight, David, because this has been a great use of time. And it's a great use of time because it's the contest of ideas. And thank you. I've asked you impertinent questions in the interests of that contest of ideas. I've asked you questions that obviously didn't particularly please you, but they shed some light on the issue at hand. So congratulations on being fearless, because there's also a shortage of that in our community. Thank you all for coming along. And as David said, it's made it for a very interesting evening. I'll hand you back to Jody, and as well as having a drink, you can also buy a copy and get it signed. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you very much. And if you don't mind leaving Melbourne, feel free to come and join us outside the ACT Supreme Court for the sentencing on the 12th of March. There's going to be quite a few supporters there, and we're going to make it memorable. Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you, David.